So I would like to explore this quality, its teaching of metta, a little bit more thoroughly this afternoon. This teaching of metta, of boundless friendliness, it has its origins in one of the earliest recorded collections of the Buddha's teaching called the Sutta Nipata. And it's the place where in the very early days of the Buddha's teaching life, he began to put this enormous emphasis upon developing a heart of immeasurable kindness, of befriending. And when you look, if you ever have the interest to look at the discourses of the Buddha, you will see that this teaching of metta is one that is constantly repeated. It's a thread that weaves its way through the entirety of the teaching. It's certainly stressed and emphasized as being one of the pivotal, foundational qualities of insight, a key to bringing suffering to an end, and as a very direct path of awakening our own heart's capacity for a boundless and immeasurable friendliness. As the Buddha put it, he says, metta ennobles the heart. It ennobles our lives. It leads to awakening. The more that I practice and teach, the more do I understand how very thin the membrane is between the path of metta and all of the other practices of meditation. We could ask, what is metta without mindfulness? We could also ask, what is mindfulness without metta? Sometimes it's translated, as I've mentioned already, this willingness to stand near to, the willingness to be close to, the willingness to stand next to. If we really see that the essence of mindfulness is essentially to turn towards all things. So the essence of mindfulness in turning towards all events and experiences is, it's a kind of antidote to the more conditioned tendency to abandon, to forsake, to disconnect. So if the essence of mindfulness is to turn towards all events and experience, then the essence of metta is to befriend that which we turn towards, to be close to have a dialogue with, a relationship with, the simple truths of each moment. Now, I think we can easily translate this into our own experience and life and perhaps get a sense of how true it is that we really don't understand anything or anyone from a distance, except on a conceptual or theoretical level. We don't generally forgive from a distance. Nor do we find joy or generosity from a distance. And I think we probably all acknowledge that a genuine compassion in our lives is not a remote offering. It is something that is forged and that is born, often in the midst of the deepest pain and suffering. Look at our own lives. How often in our lives we are really being asked to stand near to joy and to stand near to sorrow, to stand near to heartache and to fear, to stand near to the people we love and also the people that we struggle with. Think of our inner world, how much we are asked to be close to and to stand near to both the difficult and the lovely emotions and thoughts that make up each of our days. And what about everything that our bodies can experience and will experience in this life? The pains, the illnesses, the discomforts, the distress. These are not healed from a distance. They are not embraced from a distance. And they are clearly not befriended from a distance. Metta is an enabling quality. It enables a relationship. It enables a dialogue. It seems that without metta in this life, without this capacity, the only options left to us are avoidance and fear and aversion and a disconnected life. A disconnected life. Now this willingness, and I would really speak about it as a willingness. It is a willingness and it is a capacity. The willingness almost comes to us in this life when we really, really see for ourselves that the alternative options of abandonment actually only lead to further disconnection. Then we cultivate the willingness. But capacity is something here too. You know, metta is not something that just a few lucky people have the capacity to do and others are just sort of disbarred. Capacity is something born because we cultivate it, we practice it, we apply it, we embody it again and again and again. We build our capacity. But it is the ground of insight. It's the ground of understanding. And it's the deepest sense, in its deepest sense, I think it's the beginning of a liberated heart. I think for many of us in our lives, this capacity and willingness to engage with befriending is probably the most significant step we ever take in bringing suffering and distress to an end. The Buddha referred to it in the Pali as cittavimutti, the liberation of the heart through kindness. The liberation of the heart through compassion, through joy, and through equanimity. And there's a path of awakening. Tartung Kuku, he once spoke about it as loving compassion is like sunlight, awakening and bringing joy to beings. Its beauty is like a rainbow, lifting the hearts of all it touches. And metta, I think, has not only a direct relationship with all of the other Brahma-viharas of the ennobling qualities, it's actually the base of them. I think metta is the beginning of compassion. Compassion is often described as an embodied metta, an enacted metta. If we wish to understand the nature of joy, then we are asked to understand what it means to really stay close to all things, to stand near to all things, so that we can be touched. If we wish to understand what unshakable poise and balance is, the very nature of equanimity, it begins, I think, also with understanding what metta is. Longchenpa, some of you may be familiar with this quote, where he says, out of the soil of friendliness grows the bloom of compassion, watered by the tears of joy, and sheltered under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. The interwoven nature of all of these qualities. And this quality of metta, of boundless friendliness, as I've mentioned, is not an emotion. And it's not a particular state. It is something much more like an attitudinal commitment. Like an attitudinal commitment that we make to all things and to all moments. And it's always relational. So it's really talking about how we are present in this life. How we are present with the waves of thought, of feelings, of people, of events, of experiences that really make up our world of the moment. This attitudinal commitment is something that we do cultivate. It's a path. It is like any other path of meditation. It is a conscious, intentional cultivation. Recognizing, as I mentioned always earlier, that we are always, in every moment of our lives, enacting and manifesting something. And what we act and what we enact inwardly, of course, seeps through into our words, our actions, our choices, what we give priority to, what we commit ourselves to. Metta is a conscious cultivation. We don't have to feel it to enact it. That's interesting. We don't actually have to feel it to enact it. Some time ago, I went to a workshop offered by a group of people called Combatants for Peace. I don't know if any of you have ever come across this group. But it's a group of people made up of ex-Israeli soldiers and ex-Palestinian militants. And all of these people in this day that they offered, they all spoke about their shared history with war and with conflict and with violence that had been with them since the time they were born. They all told different stories. Some of their families being killed, some of killing others. One young Palestinian man, 27 years old, had spent 12 years of his life in an Israeli prison. And they all spoke about the ways in which hatred and mistrust and fear had permeated their lives for as long as they could remember. And some in this group didn't even share a common language. They had to translate between each other. But they did share a commitment. They all spoke about the turning point in their hearts and in their lives, when they saw in some unshakable way that they did not want their past to be their future. And they committed themselves to this group, this Combatants for Peace. They actually committed themselves to peace. Now, as you could imagine, if you put yourself in any of these people's shoes, this would be no easy thing. Because they saw, and it was even evident in the day that they offered, you know, they were still arguing with each other a lot of the time, you know. Like it didn't take very much to spark an argument. But it was something very alive, and they talked about the ways that they saw that their past arising again and again in the present with their memories, their emotions, their stories of hurt, their stories of resentment, their stories of rage. And they saw all this, and they committed themselves to walking a different pathway. And for me, this is almost the essence of metta. That commitment to walking a different pathway, to knowing that just as our memories and our stories of rage and anger and ill will and hurt arise in the present, so too arises in the present the possibility of reinforcing and solidifying those stories, feeding them, and then maintaining suffering. Or come to know, really through a conscious cultivation of metta, what it is to radically change our mind of the moment. but it is to radically change our heart of the moment and so to change our world at the moment. When I went to this day offered by this group, I was so deeply touched by the size of their undertaking. What these young men and women had committed themselves to. But because not only did they share this history of hatred and mistrust, but in choosing to walk the pathway that they did, it was such an act of courage. Because many of them had been rejected by their families and their communities in choosing to walk. You know, they didn't get a lot of applause for this. Mostly they got blame, they got censure, they got tremendous emotional pull to sort of come back to what was more familiar. So the path they walked was actually two simultaneous pathways. One was a very personal pathway, I think inwardly, of learning what it meant to change these ancient and these historical legacies of emotion and reactivity. But the other pathway that they walked was how that manifested in the world. What they actually committed themselves to. So they did many things. They would walk after bulldozers that had uprooted olive plantations and replant the trees. They would go into communities that had been bulldozed and help to rebuild the houses. They would safeguard children walking to school. To love each other, I think they would have honestly acknowledged, would be really asking too much. To undo the past was also asking the impossible. But they could learn, and they manifested in what they were doing, that they could learn what it meant, what it means to stand next to and to stand near to all of this chaotic world, inwardly and outwardly. So metta, I think in understanding it, it's very important to understand it is just this kind of commitment to the heart. Commitment of the heart, but it is also something that is then translated through intention into our thoughts, into our words, into our actions, into our way of being present with all things. And I think for many people in this life, this is a tremendous act of courage because it is really swimming against the tide. In many ways, it's countercultural. In many ways, I think it's a genuine act of inner radicalism. So why did the Buddha teach and give so much emphasis to this development of a mind of boundless friendliness? Although society and our world looks very different today than it did 2,600 years ago, there is a certain timelessness to the human mind that transcends cultures, it transcends societies, it transcends individuality. There's a certain timelessness to the human mind. And the Buddha very much looked at his own life, he looked at his own mind, and he looked at the world around him. And he saw the remarkably destructive power of ill will. Was immediately evident to him. The way that ill will has such power to leech joy from our lives and from our hearts. The power that ill will has to create estrangement and fear and alienation. The power that ill will has, in a way, to stifle our capacity for integrity, for responsiveness, for compassion, and the ways in which ill will essentially only has one outcome, which is to create and to recreate suffering and pain and sorrow in our lives and in our world. When the Buddha looked at his own mind, he saw that there were three primary tendencies that keep us entangled in confusion and separation and despair. And it's good it's a short list, you know. I mean, there's a lot of long lists in Buddhist teaching. It's good it's a short list. Greed, ill will, and delusion. It's not hard for us to remember. It's very easy to kind of dissociate this and to think this happens to other people. It's very important, and what the Buddha really encouraged is this kind of inner exploration. And to look at the ways in which greed, ill will, and delusion keeps us entangled in suffering, in pain, and in sorrow. These are not separate tendencies. They are a tangled knot. So what is the purpose? What is the primary purpose of cultivating a mind of boundless friendliness? It's to untangle this knot. It's to untangle the knot, to uproot the tendencies of ill will, greed, and delusion. I think the Buddha put it, one who actively develops metta, mindfully and without limit, will see their clinging fade and their bonds become worn thin. I want to emphasize the word actively. So where do we actively cultivate metta? Actively, consciously. Well, no surprise. It's in all the moments of ill will. It's in all the moments of aversion that arise. The willingness to stand close to aversion. The willingness to stand next to ill, all the flickers of ill will, the little ones and the big ones, rather than to flee from them. I mean, ill will is kind of, you know, again, it's one of those, seems like one of those awkward phrases. But it has many faces and many forms. You know, there are the gross ones of hatred, of blame, of contempt, of condemnation, the basis of all forms of prejudice, all forms of oppression in our world. But it has a lot more subtle faces too, ill will. Judgment, envy, jealousy, impatience, resistance. I think ill will even manifests at times as a kind of numbness, and I also think that fantasy can at times be a form of ill will. Now, both mindfulness and metta, we can say that their inclination is to turn towards and to stand near to all events, experiences, and people. What we see that the tendency of ill will or the inclination of ill will is to turn away from. It is to reject, it is to deny, it's to avoid, it's to suppress, it is to resist, to distance and to flee from. There's a most wonderful teaching in one of the Tibetan traditions. It says, we should not be afraid of the passions that lead us to embrace all sentient beings in the arms of compassion. But we should be afraid of the passions that lead us to forsake any sentient being. The passion that mostly leads us to forsake any sentient being is the passion of ill will. So cultivating metta in the midst of ill will is an insight practice. It's because it's concerned with understanding for ourselves with what keeps the toxic tendency of ill will going. I think we can probably all accept that things don't have an independent self-existence. You know, there is no emotion, no mental state, no form of experience that has an independent self-existence. And this also applies to ill will. So what is it that keeps it going? Because it's so strange, isn't it? Because ill will is so contradictory to what most of us value, long for, and aspire to. I don't think I've ever met anyone who held the ambition to become the most hateful person in the world. I mean, it is just, there's this strange dissonance, isn't there, between what we long for and aspire to and value, and at times what we find ourselves actually getting embedded in or practicing. So it's very important for us to understand what is it that keeps it going. It's a lot of things that keep it going, actually. It's a lot of different conditions that keep it going. Now, one aspect of ill will, and I would really invite you to look at this in your own experience, if you can find the willingness to explore this most difficult landscape of ill will. One thing that becomes immediately apparent is the voice of selfing is very loud. Have you noticed that? I really hate this. You know, I really can't bear this. I really need to get rid of this. I really don't like this. You know, I really want to annihilate this. Now, it's almost like the stronger the aversion is the strength of the voice of selfie. What that does, of course, when ill will is flavoring our sense of self in the moment, it creates a very solid other. The other that we dislike. The other that we hate, the other that we fear. Now, sometimes that other is an external other. It's a person we can't bear. It's an experience we fear. But sometimes the other that is created is even part of our own being. For some people with chronic pain or chronic illness, that becomes the other. Sometimes it's not even chronic. Sometimes it's just a twitch in our knee and it becomes the other. Sometimes it's an emotion that we don't feel, a depression, a sadness, an anxiety that we don't feel that we can bear. Sometimes it's an obsessional thinking pattern inwardly that becomes the other. The strength of the other grows proportionately to the degree of ill will, as does a degree of selfie. It's very useful, I think, very helpful to explore this dynamic within our own experience. What do we do with the other in our life? Well, we're prone to turn away from, or we want to justify our aversion. We have very big stories. We have very big narratives about the other. It is almost our way of almost feeling more at ease with the ill will. I think it is so important to find in ourselves the gentleness and the kindness and the tender curiosity to bring to this landscape of ill will in all its forms, rather than following it and rather than heaping ill will upon ill will. Because again, strangely, this is a great Western expertise, probably it's a universal expertise, but I think in a guilt-defined society, you know, we often even are better at heaping ill will upon ill will. Oh, I am so aversive. I'm such a terrible person for feeling so much aversion. How do we kind of stop these cycles? Metta teaches us to touch all moments and all experience with kindness, including the moments of aversion, including the moments of ill will. Perhaps it becomes equal, let's look at this formula in a different way, because perhaps it becomes equally clear to us that when ill will is not present, When we're in a moment in our life when there's a greater kindness, a greater tolerance, a greater equanimity, a greater sense of spaciousness and compassion, in truth, when we're in any moment of our lives, when the more wholesome and skillful qualities of heart are present, do you notice how the sense of selfing and other becomes much quieter? Becomes just much softer. Notice a genuine moment of generosity, of kindness, of care. You know, there's much less story, isn't there? You don't have the story, you know. Why was I so kind? I don't know why. I don't know why I was so kind. I don't know why I was patient. You know, I'm not a patient person. I shouldn't be so patient. Have you noticed how the narrative becomes much quieter? It becomes much... There's something actually very, I think, very helpful about seeing that. About just seeing how those formulas work within ourselves. Notice it in our day. In what kind of climate, in what kind of inner climate, does the idea of a separate, a fragile, a fearful, defended sense of self arise and thrive? And in what kind of inner climate does the sense of a separate self and an estranged other begin to fall away? The Buddha stressed so strongly this teaching that nothing has an independent self-existence. And in many ways, what we do in this practice is we cultivate the conditions inwardly, in which kindness and the falling away of a sense of solidified self and an estranged other really can fall away. And we learn to understand and to release the conditions in which a solidified self and all its ill will and defensiveness begin to release the conditions in which that can thrive. We don't shout at ourselves to let go of aversion. I think most of you would find this really is not very effective. And it is why the Buddha so firmly put this entire pathway into the context of cultivating wholesome, liberating, ennobling conditions of heart and mind in which understanding and in which metta and which compassion can thrive. Much of the practice of metta is really devoted to understanding and to dispelling this illusion and this delusion of a separated self and an estranged other. Understanding the process of constructing a self and constructing another, and really beginning in that to be able to appreciate our shared humanity, in which we equally long for kindness, for care, for acceptance, for respect and understanding, in which we equally long for the end of sorrow, and in which we can perhaps equally long for the freedom born of extinguishing ill will. I used to be in the early years of my practice, I think I was probably in some ways more of a warrior than I am now. I'm still a warrior, but I think a different kind of warrior. And I think in the early days of my practice, I was very aversion motivated. You know, and in fact, the whole of my practice took on this flavor of aversion. You know, how to sort of subdue the mind, you know, and annihilate the ill will, you know, and let go of this and cut through this and all the rest of that jargon. But I began, and really now deeply appreciate, how much deepening in this path depends upon us learning to be tender with all things. learning to be kind and tolerant with ourselves, with the person we judge or find intrusive, with the people we find cold or harsh, to know probably that in some moment of our lives we have probably been all of these things. Being tender with ourselves, knowing that our own moments of harshness and reactivity and feelings of unworthiness are born of conditions whose beginning is untraceable. Whose beginning is untraceable, but whose turning point lies within the moments of mindfulness that we can bring to our lives. So what are other conditions of ill will, some of the conditions, because they don't arise out of a vacuum. So the obvious one I've been speaking about, it is the identification with me. With a me, a separate and independent self, basically defined by my bodies, my feelings, my emotions, my perceptions, my likes and my dislikes. I think it is a definition of fear. I think it's a definition of fear. I have never seen any form of identification in this life which doesn't carry its shadow of fear, of needing to defend and to protect. I think we know, and I think somehow we know this quite intuitively, how very fragile and uncertain each of our lives actually are. I think we know this. About how vulnerable we are to this changing world of conditions that we can't control and we can't protect ourselves from. And I think it's almost as if we can't bear it. And I think in the fear and the confusion of vulnerability, we try through identification to make something solid, something fixed to protect and to defend. We make a me. We make a me. Who I am defined by what I have identified with. Even though, and this is the strange part, we don't even at times really like the me we've created. We'd rather have somebody else's. It is a limited definition which I think carries with it a current of anxiety, the fear of injury, the fear of harm, the fear of loss, the fear of failure, the fear of not being good enough. And fear, as the Buddha put it, actually is one of the most obvious manifestations of ill will. He didn't make these into two separate emotions. It seems, doesn't occur to us that a freer and a wiser and a kinder way to approach our intrinsic vulnerability would be to embrace it with kindness and compassion and courage and learning to soften and to open. I think identification, if we look at it politically, if we look at it socially, if we look at it in communities, identification is one of the primary conditions upon which ill will thrives and feeds. Ill will is one side of the coin that obstructs metta, but the other side of the coin is its close neighbor of craving. The Buddha put it that in the Metta Sutta, this encouragement, may we live contented and unburdened. We see how much craving, the kind of sister brother of ill will, is a kind of aversion, isn't it? Because it's like saying where we are, who we are, it's just not enough. It has exactly the same effect as ill will, which is to abandon what is, to reach towards a better moment, a more ideal moment, a more perfect moment than the one we are in. We can see how much craving is the not enough mind, not good enough, not acceptable enough, not perfect enough. And so the same effect happens of forsaking. Forsaking ourselves, forsaking others, and at times just forsaking where we are. The Buddha puts contentment so strongly in the fabric of metta. To learn to discover an inwardly generated contentment, rather than inhabiting a climate of insufficiency that essentially makes us a hostage to the world of conditions. If we feel that lack of contentment inwardly within ourselves, we will prowl the world for what we don't feel to be present within ourselves. It is why in this teaching, this path, the Buddha gave so much emphasis to the very deep and profound meditative development of learning to taste an inwardly generated happiness, an inwardly generated sense of sufficiency, an inwardly generated contentment, which actually liberates the world and liberates other people from the demand that they actually just make us feel happy, make us feel good enough. Contentment is what cools the agitation of craving and aversion, learning to be upright in all moments. It's almost as if learning to be present in the entire world of conditions. If metta had a mantra, it would be this too, this too. It is its unconditional nature. Now, non-identification, contentment, ease, mindfulness, integrity, these are all conditions we cultivate in which metta can thrive and in which it can flourish. But so too is courage. So too is courage. It's not easy to stand near to sorrow or to blame or to pain. It's not easy to stand near to difficult people and to difficult emotions. And metta is certainly not about being nice, and it's not about being sentimental. It's almost like these are the near enemies of metta. It's about courage. About having the courage to be still in the midst of our own waves, even the flickers of aversion, to swim against the tide. Have you noticed how quick our responses are? I mean, we don't have to be facing torment in our lives, you know, or tremendous pain. But you notice how just an unpleasant sight, or an unpleasant sound, or unpleasant sensation, and how the flickers of aversion arise, how you might go out and you just catch sight of a person who you might never even have spoken with this person, but somehow they seem to annoy you. And you notice how quickly the flicker of aversion arises. You know how you can feel it almost in the body, can't you? The sense of contractedness, the sense of tightening, and how quickly we move into judgment. How quickly we move into a kind of condemnation, the story we have, you know, about who this person is or what is happening. And then we go into avoidance. We just go into avoidance behavior. It almost seems easier to be aversive. You see how much our minds seem to love to cling to the pathways they know well. And how difficult at times it is to seem to be able to walk the pathways within our own hearts and minds that are less familiar to us. And that, quite frankly, involve quite a bit more effort. It doesn't take much effort to be aversive, you notice that? Well, I guess tried. It doesn't take much effort to be aversive. It takes a whole lot of effort to stand still amidst the waves of aversion. It takes a whole lot of conscious intentionality and application to find that willingness to stay near to that which we would rather abandon. But this is the place where mindfulness and metta so much go hand in hand. Because with mindfulness, we keep learning to pause. You know, in those moments of impulsive disconnection, those moments when we just kind of flinch away from what is, mindfulness is constantly teaching us just how to pause for a moment, how to cultivate those pregnant pauses in our lives that really do allow us to walk a different pathway. If we can pause, have the courage and the uprightness not to abandon or turn away, because we see that every moment of abandonment is reinforcing a pattern of ill will. If we have the courage to pause, we actually see we have the courage to befriend. These two go so closely together. It is very easy, as I think I said earlier today, to think that the small moments of aversion don't really matter. But our participation in them, of course, makes them into the building blocks of the great waves of fear and aversion that we can feel so powerless before. We don't have to love the difficult. It's even why, you know, I know metta is often translated as loving kindness, which not a totally accurate translation, I must say, but it's why I think some people just feel like metta is not possible for them, because they think they're being asked to love the difficult. But that may be asking too much. We don't have to love the difficult. We don't even have to like it. But we can learn to not forsake it. We can learn not to abandon it. And to plant the seeds again and again of metta, of befriending. And those seeds, with practice, grow into the possibilities of boundless friendliness. When we hear the words boundless or immeasurable metta, they're quite big words, you know. I mean, that means unshakable. But that's not where we start. It's not where we start. We start with abounded friendliness. We start with conditions. We start with a metta that does feel very miserable. But that is why it's a practice, that we plant the seeds where we are. One thing that I feel is deeply important about understanding metta is not to have it as a noun, but to turn it into a verb. To entertain the possibility of befriending this aching body, befriending this difficult thought, befriending this difficult moment in our lives, a genuine intentionality. In my understanding, the cultivation of metta is and always has been a path of awakening. It's illuminating all the places and all the moments where ill will casts its shadow. It's a knowing that ill will is suffering. It's a knowing the kind of worlds that we construct inwardly and outwardly, moment to moment in our life. And it's a taking care of ill will. It's responding to ill will with metta as a dedication to bringing suffering to an end. And this is not about your suffering. It's not about my suffering. It's not about your ill will or about my ill will. It is simply recognizing that in this world we all participate in, that we are all part of constructing the world that we live in. At times, metta is effortless, and at times it takes a lot of effort. But what I have certainly discovered in this practice, in this path, that what takes a lot of effort initially does with practice turn into something that is more effortless. And we're learning moment to moment to incline the mind. I want to end with a story that some of you may be familiar with. A young man who had just completed his spiritual training and was eagerly intent on becoming a teacher moved to a new town. He tried to teach, but no one came. The only spiritual interest in the town were the many followers of a wise and well-known rabbi. Frustrated, the young teacher devised a plan to embarrass the old master and gain students for himself. He captured a small bird and one day went to where the master was seated, surrounded by many disciples. Holding the small bird in his hand, he spoke directly to the master. "If you are so wise, tell me now, is this bird in my hand alive or is it dead?" His plan was this. If the master said the bird was dead, he would open his hand, the bird would fly away, the master would be wrong, and students would come to him. If the master said the bird was alive, he would quickly crush the bird in his hand and open it and say, "See, the bird is dead." Again, the master would be wrong, and the young teacher would gain students. So he sat poised in front of the master, demanding an answer. "Tell me, if you are so wise, is this bird alive or is it dead?" The master looked back at him with great compassion and answered quite simply, "Really, my friend, it's up to you." And I often think of this as metta, that it's up to us. It's up to us. So if we have just a moment quietly together, then I have a little bit of time if there's any reflections for us.